My next guest is Todd Rosenbluth, head of ETF and mutual fund research at CFRA, a leading independent provider of investment research and analysis. Todd spearheads all of their ETF coverage there, and he's now on the line with me from New York. Todd, always a pleasure. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nate. Great to be back with you.
Okay, we are going to jump right in here, and I want to start with ETF flows because we're right up against a calendar year record. As a matter of fact, I saw Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas tweeted this morning that with the Bloomberg data, that annual record has now been eclipsed. And of course, we're only at the end of July. It's clearly been a monster year for ETFs so far. I'd love to hear sort of your perspective here. You know, obviously, we've had the supportive backdrop of the financial markets. I would say that's probably the biggest driver. But what do you make of the inflows this year?
Well, it's been a tremendous demand. I actually thought the intro music would have been from like the 1980s, Sweet 16, Bar Mitzvahs, Weddings of Celebrate Good Times. because $500 billion in just under 7 months, which is the data that we at CFRA have as well, is just amazing to see. We've seen institutional investors that entered the market using ETFs probably in many cases for the first time in 2020. Were active in the first half of 2021. We've seen advisors continue to shift towards ETF strategies. You know, Vanguard has already matched what was a crazy $200 billion of net inflows in this seven-month period. We've seen Invesco, we've seen Schwab, we've seen Global X have more money pouring into their ETFs thus far than all of 2020. So it's not just been one firm. It's not just been one style. And I guess lastly, I would just note is this is a completely different market than we saw in 2020, a rotation towards value over growth. So ETFs like VTV or more equally weighted version of the S&P 500 with RSP from Invesco, and then demand for thematic ETFs has continued to accelerate with a shifting number of themes that fit the current moment as opposed to the prior one. So it's been a tremendous year so far, and we've got 5 months to go.
Well, in those last 5 months that we have ahead of us, I mean, any predictions in terms of where we end up on flows? And again, it's obviously market dependent, but let's just say we have a relatively normal market. I mean, what do you think happens here?
Well, I think we could hit the $7 trillion mark by the end of the year. We probably will see a slowdown in the pace of flows. July has been slower than prior months. The summer tends to be, and certainly when there's market volatility and then a acceleration is common in the fourth quarter. So we could see another $300 billion of money flowing in to ETFs. And then if the market rallies, as it tends to do in the fourth quarter, that could get us there as well. So I think we're going to keep ticking off milestones. It may not happen $7 trillion by the end of December. It could fall to January or February, but I think the snowball continues to get larger in the ETF space.
Yeah, and we're currently sitting at $6.6 trillion, right around there. And you mentioned milestones. Right. I love giving these stats, so bear with me here. So I looked, SPY, of course, the first ETF that launched in January of 1993. Well, ETFs as a whole in the U.S. did not hit $1 trillion until December 2010. They then hit $2 trillion in December 2014, $3 trillion in July 2017. And then listen to this. So $4 trillion in July 2019, $5 trillion in November 2020, and $6 trillion in April 2021. And let's just say we hit $7 trillion, you know, towards the end of the year or January next year. It's pretty remarkable. And yes, I get that each trillion is easier, right? Because as ETF assets increase, you know, it makes that growth easier, but still pretty amazing, however you slice it.
Oh, certainly, because there's what's happening is we're seeing investors that are getting exposure to using ETFs as the structure of choice. They remain comfortable. They tell other people about it. It's a spiral effect of institutional investors see other institutional investors having a good experience. They then take a chance at ETFs, and people continue to do so. And I think obviously the conversion from mutual funds to ETFs is a sign that the asset management industry is further embracing ETFs as opposed to the old school mutual funds of of our parent state.
100%. I mean, what do we see? $30 billion in mutual fund ETF conversions from DFA, and certainly more to come. Okay, Todd, so in addition to the record flows, we're also seeing this acceleration in ETF launches this year. I know you recently wrote a piece on this. I mean, high level, can you offer some perspective on this as well? And then I do want to get your take on a few specific new ETFs.
Sure. So there were just over 200 ETFs and ETNs that launched in the first half of 2021. That's an acceleration of what we've seen in prior years. Obviously, 2020 being impacted in part by COVID. We've seen more than 20 in July. In the first half, two-thirds of these products are some form of active management. Either they're the defined outcome suite of products that we and others consider active management through the use of options, or the semi-transparent products like Fidelity offers and T. Rowe Price offers, or the fully transparent products that we've seen have success. And both newer entrants into the marketplace and more established firms entering in with the ETF space. So if I can just touch on a couple of examples.
Yeah, please.
In the active space. So Franklin, which Franklin Templeton has a lot of low-cost oriented products. They launched Franklin Exponential Data ETF, XDAT. It's still an extremely small ETF, but what caught my eye, or catches our eye at CFRA, is this is run by a well-established and strong-performing manager of one of their mutual funds. So they've taken their in-house expertise to it. And then a second product, which maybe we were going to get to, but is INFL, which is an inflation beneficiary ETF from Horizon Kinetics, their first ETF. And it gathered over $600 million in the first 6 months of life, but not all at once, but drip by drip of new money and just cranking their way on it are two of the interesting active ones. And if I can touch on an index one, because I know you have a list of other ones to touch on. I recently wrote about QQQA, which is a ProShares ETF. It's tied to the NASDAQ 100, but with a momentum twist to this large cap growth strategy. And it's 21 stocks that have the highest momentum characteristics. Sometimes that includes the FANG oriented stocks, and sometimes it doesn't. So it currently owns Facebook and Alphabet, but it doesn't own Netflix and Google and Microsoft, among others. So it's just an interesting product that I think is another evolution even within the index space.
No, I always love how you unearth some of these ETFs that may fly under the radar of other investors. You mentioned INFL. That is one that jumped out to me. I mentioned this on Twitter. I mean, to me, that's probably the breakout hit of the year this year so far, just given that this was a new issuer and seeing how much success it's had and clearly timing some of the concerns around inflation perfectly. Two stats I want to mention briefly, and then I have a couple other ETFs, as you mentioned, I do want to ask you about. But in your research piece, you noted that 76 asset fund families have launched a product in the first half of 2021. That just jumped off the page at me. And then we're right now right at about 2,600 ETFs overall. Pretty remarkable, you know, how quickly the space is growing. In terms of the new ETFs that you know, have caught my attention, let me give you a few others here. So VUSB, the Vanguard Ultra Short Bond ETF, that's already over $1 billion in assets, just launched in April. ARKX, which I know everybody was all over this launch, that's the ARK Space Exploration and Innovation ETF. But you know, I look, this is already over $600 million, just launched at the end of March. And to me, this shows the power of Cathie Wood, because you look at the Procure Space ETF UFO, which I love Andrew Channon, and they were first to market, which I think they should get a lot of credit for. That launched in April of 2019, but it only has $125 million. And a lot of those assets have come since ARK first announced their space ETF. So what's interesting to me here is, again, just that gravitational pull, no pun intended here, of Cathie Wood. And then I'll give you one more, which I don't think is going to surprise you, SPBC. So that's the Simplify U.S. Equity Plus GBTC. Of course, that's a Grayscale Bitcoin Trust ETF. That launched in May and is already over $100 million, which to me, I think that shows the power of investors wanting Bitcoin exposure. I was actually visiting earlier with EETF Trends' Tom Hendrickson and going through a list of the top 10 ETFs in terms of engagement on their platform, and two of them were blockchain ETFs. To me, that's showing that investors, they want exposure to the space. They can't get it through a pure Bitcoin ETF, and so they're looking at some of these other workaround products. But I guess any quick thoughts on any or all of those ETFs?
Well, I'll just highlight to me what is obvious is that investors don't care about how long an ETF has been around. If they get
Good
the
point.
Investment concept, they understand what's inside it, the fees, they're with an asset manager that they're comfortable with. The three-year anniversary that has existed for mutual funds for years is just not relevant in the ETF space, and you're citing perfect examples. You know, Vanguard, an ultra-short bond ETF, that's a pretty simple concept to understand. And if you work with Vanguard already, and it's 10 basis points, that's easy to determine that that makes sense. I'll take the bait with the Bitcoin-related products.
So I knew it.
We can maybe check that off the box. And I asked on Twitter how early we'd get the word Bitcoin would come out of your mouth in the interview. So, well, we're at 10:35 Eastern time. Mine, 9:35 yours. I think we're 15 minutes into the conversation. So ahead of my anticipation. But this is just a creative way of getting exposure to Bitcoin. And it's a smart way of doing it. Whether or not I believe or you believe people should have it within their portfolio, it's a managed way of having exposure. It's a tax-efficient way of having exposure. They do the work. They, being Simplify, does it for you. It makes a lot of sense for somebody who wants exposure to it through an ETF wrapper. And I don't think, getting ahead of myself, I don't think we're going to see an ETF for Bitcoin directly in 2021. So this is the best way of getting exposure to it.
Well, let's talk more about that. I'm going to take your bait from my bait, and I didn't take Tom Hendrickson's bait earlier talking about Bitcoin ETFs. But look, we saw another filing for a Bitcoin ETF last week from GlobalX. I believe we're now up to 13 known filings. And I say known because it's possible that somebody like Grayscale or Bitwise that they have filed something behind the scenes. Certainly not a 19b-4, but it's possible they've put in their initial filing. You mentioned not seeing one this year. I would agree with that. I mean, I've grown much more pessimistic as time has gone on now that we've seen Gensler show his hands a little bit. I mean, Tom, where do you think we're at in this? I mean, what do you think the SEC needs to see? Do you think there is a bigger force here at play in terms of the U.S. government not wanting to implicitly endorse Bitcoin and therefore not allowing the SEC to approve a Bitcoin ETF? I mean, any thoughts you would offer on this topic?
So my insight is based on what the SEC is saying. So what they're saying is they have concerns about fraud, and they're saying they have concerns about some form of Bitcoin in an ETF structure that cannot be closed when there's unexpected demand, both high and low. And that's certainly going to happen. There's people lining up to buy the product outside an Apple store before them even announcing that there's a new product, if I can butcher an analogy. So I think it's what's encouraging is that these are some well-established asset managers like GlobalX and VanEck and WisdomTree and ARK that are not just jumping in with an ETF, but this is part of their broader lineup. And this is an extension of what they're doing with some of the blockchain-related products or digital assets. Each of those firms has some connection to it. I just don't know what moves the needle for the SEC. I think it's hard to disprove the negative that fraud is not being done, or that these products will not face a run on the bank, so to speak, when people look to exit. I don't know that that's true, but it's hard for them to disprove it. So I'm skeptical that we're going to see one under the current administration's leadership of the SEC, but hopefully I'll be surprised. I'd rather talk about a live product than a theoretical one.
What's interesting to me, and I'll leave it at this, is that if you look at some of the comments from people who are closely tied to the ETF space. So I'll give you an example, like Gray King over at Osprey. He comes to mind. The partners over at Wilshire Phoenix, if you look at their comments, they are very pessimistic. And in fact, I saw something from the Wilshire Phoenix camp that they don't think there would be, or there could be a Bitcoin ETF until like 2023. And so when I see that from people who have worked directly with the SEC, it is hard to be optimistic. Okay, Todd, with our remaining time here, you were mentioning on these new launches that you don't need a three-year track record. And obviously that gets into a topic that's near and dear to your heart, which is, hey, look, make sure you're doing your due diligence, doing your homework on ETFs, looking under the hood. And I want to talk about a piece you wrote a few weeks ago that was titled, "Is Your ETF Using a New Rulebook?" And to me, the gist here is that if you look at index-based ETFs, some of them change their benchmarks more often than investors may realize. And I actually talked about this on last week's podcast with ETF Trends' Dave Noddick. We discussed ICLN, the iShares Global Clean Energy ETF. They changed indexes. But here's my question to you. I mean, isn't this just active management? I know people say all investing decisions are active, and I think there's truth to that. But investors that are buying into these index-based ETFs and then see those indexes change and they may not be aware of it, I guess I have two concerns. I mean, one, is this active? And then two, I mean, how often do investors realize these indexes are changing?
So I think infrequently that people realize it, or it's very rare that people understand what's happening. So an asset manager will update their prospectus. They might put out a press release, but they might not put out a press release that they're making changes, and then they make the change a few months later. So we were seeing a number of them happening in the first half of 2021, enough to go into our database to see that there were 267 index changes between January 2016 and June of 2021. So let me make that easier. More than 50 each year. And that includes obviously half the year not being done for 2021. It depends upon which product we're talking about. So I wrote about recently how iShares is changing the index behind MUB, which is their national muni ETF, and SUB, which is their short-term national muni ETF. And what they're doing is basically adding they're largely doubling the number of municipal bonds that the manager can sample from with this new index. Assuming that they make this change once, as opposed to every couple of years, then that's okay as long as you're not solely relying on the track record, because the track record is less meaningful when they've changed the index. There's other ones, typically when it's a smaller ETF, where they make a radical change. So a couple that come to mind within that recent period of time, State Street took a crossover fixed income product that invested in investment grade and high yield bonds and turned it into SPHY to make a cheap version of JNK. It's now only high yield bonds. It's now cheaper than everybody else. It's a way of using an existing product and gathering additional assets. That's not the same product. That's okay. It's not the same product, but you certainly can't rely on past performance to use it. So I don't want to go through every example out there. It's just, it's important to have an understanding of what is inside the portfolio today and put that performance record in perspective and don't rely too much on it when you're doing your analysis.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I feel like it's a reminder that you can't just set it and forget it with index-based ETFs, because it is possible things change over time. And Todd, just a couple minutes left here, sort of on a related note, I've seen a couple of really good articles lately. So I saw one from Matt Krantz over at investors.com, and then there was one from Jessica Feringer over at etf.com. And both had to do with, again, your favorite topic, knowing what's inside an ETF. And they specifically talked about the growing popularity of thematic ETFs and how those products might require even greater due diligence by investors. And look, I know you always say, look under the hood, right? But I thought it'd be good. Can you just offer some real tangible action items for investors who are looking at thematic ETFs? Like how do you approach this space from a CFR rating perspective?
So, and thanks for that. So we at CFRA, what we do, we look at the holdings, we look at the performance record, sentiment, and cost. For a thematic ETF, we treat the same as everything else. So we have an opinion on individual stocks from a valuation and risk perspective that may or may not be connected to the theme. And if it owns stocks we like, that's a good thing. If it owns stocks we don't like, that's less of a good thing, and the fund will get rated lower. So let me just pick an example. I know ARKX, the space exploration ETF, I didn't touch on when you talked about it. It owns Deere. You know, I'll probably find a way to connect, and I'm sure Kathy Wood could find a way to connect Deere to space exploration. It's not my opinion whether or not it fits in appropriately in a space ETF. We have a buy recommendation on Deere from a construction and an agricultural equipment perspective. So we like ARKX ownership of the stock. Is it appropriate in a space-themed ETF? Are you stretching the boundaries? That's important for an investor to make on their own. We're not putting our thumb on the scale to be able to say that. So we think you should, importantly, with thematic ETFs, you can't just buy the largest, you can't just buy the cheapest, you can't just buy the best performer. You need to look at it and make your own decision as to do you like what's inside the portfolio, and do they own things that you think either make sense, or often companies that are small caps you never heard of, but when you do a little bit of homework, you see, they're the leading company within this cybersecurity segment or that space exploration segment. That's the homework investors need to do. We're hoping to help them, but they've got to do a lot of the legwork on their own.
All right, Todd, so I'm going to recap our conversation here. ETF growth and momentum is accelerating. ETF innovation is alive and well. There's not going to be a Bitcoin ETF. You don't need a three-year track record for an ETF to invest in it. And look under the hood. Those are the Todd Rosenbluth words of wisdom this week. Always enjoy visiting. For listeners, go follow Todd on Twitter, @ToddCFRA. Thanks for joining me this week, Todd.
Thanks, Nate. Enjoyed it.
That was Todd Rosenbluth, head of ETF and mutual fund research at CFRA.